And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552. Or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Today, we have Captain Robert E. Arnold, who is a retired naval officer who was an instructor in advanced trauma life support for the Department of Defense. He was also a member of Fleet Surgical Team 4 and has had several deployments ranging from the Arctic Circle to the Indian Ocean. While a civilian, Captain Arnold practiced general surgery and was the assistant coroner for Jefferson County for 5 years. He has utilized these experiences and the actual witness statements in the National Archives instead of the frequently used newspaper accounts of the day to reconstruct the events concerning the assassination of President Lincoln and the escape of John Wilkes Booth. This account is significantly different than previously published accounts. Captain Arnold is now retired and resides in Louisville, Kentucky, with his wife, Betty, of 60 years. A new examination of the facts surrounding the violent death of President Abraham Lincoln, gathered by a retired naval officer and surgeon slash coroner, raises many valid questions about the generally accepted story of that assassination and its aftermath. The idea for this book arose 20 years ago after author Captain Robert E. Arnold, M.D., read an article about the identity and autopsy of John Wilkes Booth. The evidence presented in that article seemed at odds with the doctor who was able to determine from the photographs and written accounts. Arnold is clear from the outset. Booth, and only Booth, actually killed President Lincoln by a pistol shot in public theater. He describes Booth as an egotistical actor with Southern sentiments who considered Lincoln a wrong-sided politician. Booth wanted to kidnap the president while the war was still raging, but decided on assassination when it was clear the South had lost. But Arnold, like many other theorists, is sure that Booth did not act alone. The author names very likely conspirators, highly placed in the Union Army and government, the main one being Edwin Statton. According to Arnold, Statton, who was serving an assistant to Lincoln's Secretary of War, was a very radical Republican who had made himself one of the most powerful men in Washington through his connections to the military. Statton and others like him felt strongly that the South should be punished after the war and feared that Lincoln and his like-minded colleague Seward would institute policies are reconciliation policies that threaten the radical Republican power base. Throughout Arnold's book are photographs of the written archives he was able to access. He makes many good points that definitely suggest an assassination conspiracy rather than a lone perpetrator. He also questions the death of Booth, believing it to have been staged. One piece of evidence he offers in support of this idea is that Booth's body was taken to the U.S. Montauk, where by remarkable coincidence, there were a number of people on board who could absolutely swear that the body was that of Booth. Also, a photograph of the corpse was ordered but never presented, and Booth's diary, entrusted to Statton, was later produced, with 18 pages missing. There are several extant theories about the Booth's survival, yet surprisingly, the U.S. government has never approved DNA testing that could establish the identity of Booth's purported remains. The outstanding element of Arnold's narrative is that it begins with action and never deviates from action. The theoretical pieces are peripheral to the intense drama of these remarkable events. The cold-blooded murder of a much-admired American, the pursuit and subsequent hanging of the presumed perpetrators, including one woman, all taking place during the somber days of mourning the slain president and the inevitable chaos within a government left without its leader. Mysterious notes, conflicting eyewitness accounts, assignations, denials, and record-keeping, often in handwriting only, all serve to heighten the drama as depicted by Arnold. There is no doubt who fired the fatal shot. Arnold invites interested or concerned readers to think seriously about the many possible conflicting facets that touch upon this historic tragedy. This is truly a great read and a vast historical account of Lincoln's assassination. The amount of research required to write this book was tremendous. The Conspiracy Between John Wilkes Booth and the Union Army to Assassinate Abraham Lincoln by Robert E. Arnold can be purchased at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. Please welcome today retired Naval officer, surgeon, assistant coroner, and author Robert E. Arnold to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Doc.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How's the weather over there in Louisville?
Wet.
Well, I can say here in sunny Florida, it's sunny. No problems here. Let's first talk about your career in the Navy and the medical field. Thank you for your service, by the way. Talk about some of the many accomplishments in the Navy and the medical field that you've had over the years.
I was on active duty in the Navy a little over 11 years. I was a board certified general surgeon, and I was picked to be an advanced trauma life support instructor, and I had to go to Bethesda and take intensive training in this, and then taught it for 10 years to other doctors and medical personnel like dentists and things like that, because they felt like after the Beirut bombing, if these people had some basic training, many lives could have been saved.
Right.
So that was the whole idea of it. While I was on there, while I was doing that, they also established surgical teams and put them in the Navy. And I was put to be on one of these, and I was a commanding officer of Fleet Surgical Team 4. And we saw duty in the Mediterranean. And I also had two other deployments where we went through the Suez Canal to the Persian Gulf while they do back up the minesweepers where the Persians had, Iranians had mined the Persian Gulf.
Hmm.
And I had three deployments with the Marines. During all of this, I got quite a bit of exposure to ballistics, gunshot wounds, the treatment, and I realized when I was reading about this that what they said about the death of the man in the barn was just not true. That all the stories that you heard were contrived by the government, and it comes out, in my opinion, that there was an enormous conspiracy, probably involving 75 to 100 people. And John Wilkes Booth said this himself. And the government did everything possible to restrict the knowledge, the information, to make it look like it was the spontaneous act of a lone drunk gunman.
Mm-hmm.
And they succeeded because the Union Army had kept all of the information, all of the letters, all of the testimony, all of the exhibits, and would not release them to the public. And they were kept by the Army for almost 100 years, and they were finally put in the archives and put on microfiche. Well, by that time, the story of Lincoln's demise and Booth's chase, the chase of Booth, had been gotten from the newspapers for 100 years, and it was just set in stone. But when you go in the archives and look at the actual eyewitness testimony, it's much different.
What was the trigger that got you to write this book, and that you noticed something's wrong here? I need to tell the public about it.
The trigger was, funny enough, I had a dental appointment. I was in a dentist's office at the Navy.
Uh-huh.
And there was a little booklet called Navy Medicine,
right,
which is published once every 2 months, and it had a little article in there about the autopsy,
mm-hmm,
of the body on the Montauk. And I had nothing to do, so I read it, and the author was not a doctor, but he had brought up some interesting points. The specimen from the gunshot wound was taken to the Army Medical Museum, and the government has never let that be released to the public. But the author of the article did go see it, had a photograph of it, and I saw the photograph and realized from the bullet track that, first of all, it was not a 44 Colt revolver, and the second thing, that the angle of it meant he was shot from above, so it could not have been Sergeant Corbett, who was supposed to have shot him, who was standing on a level ground. And that's what started me, and it took a long time, and I finally accessed the archives and found out the story was much different. But this information was not released, and also much of the information that contradicts the original story, when they put it in the archives, they didn't index it. So
right,
there's no record of it. It's just sitting back in there alone. And unless you go through the archives almost page by page, you'll miss it.
Well, why do you think it took them so long to release information about this? I mean, this has so many different similarities to President Kennedy,
well,
you know?
Yeah, the Army had absolute control of it.
Uh-huh.
They kept it locked up in 7 drawers, and they just wouldn't let anybody have it. It was that simple.
Right.
And then when the archives became established, evidently there was an order to put it in the archives, which they did, but it was 100 years after Lincoln had been assassinated, and I don't think anybody looked at it. By that time, a lot of historical research was being done on a computer and whatnot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the only information somebody that was writing a book about Lincoln was getting was what was already and had been gotten from the newspapers. And so that's why they all missed this. And unless you go to the archives and look it up, what it says, you'll miss it.
The Army controlled the witness statements and the trial testimony.
Yes.
Yeah.
They controlled everything. The witness statements, the exhibits, the letters, the telegrams, anything that had to do with the assassination of Lincoln, they controlled and they kept, and they would not let anyone see it. And also, the picture on the front of my book shows the vertebra and the spinal cord. They would not let that picture be released. This is the first time that's ever been shown.
That's amazing, you know. That's a red flag right there, that something's not right.
Well, it's unbelievable. And it's just like the fake news. Then they fill the press with what they wanted and with no basis in fact.
Right.
To make it look like he was just a drunk that went in there and got mad and went up and killed Lincoln, then jumped out off the stage, out the door, and escaped.
Yeah.
And it was really meticulously done and planned, including the employees and the owners of Ford's Theater, to assist Booth in getting out.
By murdering the president, he was supposed to, I guess at first, he was supposed to kidnap the president. But things changed,
that
I guess.
Was,
yeah.
That was supposed to be, that's what it says.
Yeah.
And that's what's in the literature. And about a month before the assassination, they gave that idea up and switched to the assassination. And it took them about 3.5 weeks to get everything in place.
And they also say by murdering the president and two of his possible successors, Booth and his co-conspirators, I guess, hope to throw the U.S. government into disarray. Is that true? Was that the plan?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
They, and they thought that, then there was a forlorn hope that the Confederacy might rise again when they saw Lincoln was dead. They might take heart and take up arms again. But that was a long shot and didn't materialize. But the thing that did materialize was the Union Army was able to get in control of the Reconstruction, and the officers in control made hundreds of thousands of dollars. The graft right. was enormous. And they fattened their pockets throughout the Union Army. And that was their ultimate goal.
Now, Bill O'Reilly, you know, he goes on and on about his books. And I always question him because I'm thinking, how can this guy write so many books when he's on TV all the time, you know? So I it kind of bugs
me.
But,
yes.
But he has this guy, I guess Martin Dugars, and I think I'm saying his name right, but he wrote this, you know, Killing Lincoln and this shocking assassination that changed America forever. But there are discrepancies between your story and his story, and particularly, I guess, about the horse that was outside waiting
yes.
for Booth. Yeah, talk about the discrepancies between your book and O'Reilly's book.
Well, my O'Reilly's book says that Booth arrived there about 9 o'clock
okay.
on a horse, and the horse was a skittish horse, they call it, and couldn't right. be tied. And so he called a 14-year-old boy that worked there to come out and hold his horse, which he did, which mm-hmm. means what he said.
Right.
Then Booth goes into the theater and supposedly goes by and has some drinks in the saloon, then goes up to Lincoln's box, shoots him, and then jumps onto the stage, runs out, and gets on the horse where the boy's holding it. Well, that's not true at all. Booth got there on the horse about 6 o'clock in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and there were two witnesses, Margaret Rosier and Joseph Burris, who saw him get there and take the horse down to a little stable that had been right. built right behind the theater. And they saw him get there at 6 and leave the horse and then come back in and go into the theater. It didn't say where he went. Then about 8:30 or 9, there were three witnesses. John Morris was a colored man who worked in the theater, and John Miles was another colored man who worked from the theater, and they both said they saw Booth go down to the stable and get to the horse from the stable and take it up and call a man named Ned Spangler.
Mm-hmm.
And Spangler got another man named James Maddox to walk the horse in the alley for an hour while Booth went around to the front of the theater and waited. And he walked the horse for about an hour. And then they gave the horse to Joseph Burris, the 14-year-old boy. He only held the horse about 10 or 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he laid down on a bench about 30 feet from the door. And he was waiting there, and then when he heard the gunshot wound, he got up and took the horse to the door because he knew Booth was going to be coming out that door to lead the horse.
Right.
He also took the reins, which he'd been leading the horse by, and put it over the horse's head so the horse would be ready to go when Booth came out the door. And he had the horse 4 feet from the door waiting for Booth to get on when he got there.
Mm-hmm.
Now that proves, I think, that there had to be previous planning, and this is all in the archives with statements, and it's in the book. I included those statements.
Well, there were a lot of accounts that the horse itself was, you know, not tamed. I mean, he was kind of wild. They had to have somebody had to be there. Yeah, somebody had to be there to keep him calm, and you know, and then it stands to reason that if the murder of Lincoln was a sudden impulsive act by Booth, the horse would have still been in the stable instead of by
That's
the door,
right.
and proves
That's
that
exactly
it,
right.
it was a planned act, definitely. So that's another huge red flag, and I'm glad you brought this out in your book. Now, talk now. There's another huge major point here, the preparation of the presidential box, correct?
Yes.
That's another, you know, why, which, you know, proves that this was a planned event. The presidential box was, go ahead, I'll let you talk about it.
All right, Ned Spangler was the carpenter
for
Ford Theater.
Mm-hmm.
That was his job. And he, for 3 weeks before the assassination, Spangler moved out of his boarding house and lived in the theater for 3 weeks at night. He was there by himself. And he had all the tools, all the equipment, and he did. He went up to the box and he cut a mortise in the wall behind the door, which was 2 inches by 5 inches. Then he got a plank, which was 2 by 5, 3.5 feet long, and beveled it so it would fit right up against the jamb of the door flush. Then he put a couple of nails in it that would hold it there, and that made a perfect bar. When Booth came in, this was behind the door, and all he had to do was pick it up, put it in the mortise, and shove it against the door jamb, and the door could not be opened. It acted like a wedge.
Right.
And no matter how hard you push, this wedge would hold, and it did. Then the second thing Spangler did, they had two doors there, 7 and 8, into the presidential box. He drilled a hole in door number 7, and then which would face right where the president was going to be sitting. Then the door could be locked, had an iron lock on it. He took a screw out of the hasp on that and then bored the hole out, put the screw back in so it was just like a peg. It could be removed instantaneously because the threads didn't catch, and the door could be opened even if it was locked. That was then at the day of the assassination, they took all of the plush chairs. They had red plush chairs in the two boxes. They took the partition out between them, and then they took all of the chairs out of the box and put a rocking chair for Lincoln to sit in, and they placed it so when Lincoln was sitting in the chair, the back of his head would be lined up with the hole that had been drilled in the door.
Oh. Wow.
Then they put two other cane bottom chairs in, and one beside Lincoln and one against the wall, and then a sofa against the back wall for Major Rathbone to sit on. So when Booth came in and blocked the door, he could look through the little hole, and what he saw was the back of Lincoln's head.
Right.
And he could fire through that. Then make his escape as the way the chairs were placed.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Lincoln's chair was just a little bit behind the president, but aside that, then all Booth had to do was run through door number 8. Then he went around through in front of Mary Lincoln and swung over onto the stage by holding onto the flag and swinging that way. What happened was Lincoln, at the last minute, just before Booth was going to fire, leaned over. And he leaned so far over that he had his right arm onto the railing, and he was looking at something in the audience. He'd taken his left hand and pulled the flag aside so he could look down in the audience. When he did that, he went out of Booth's view. And the chair was between Booth couldn't use the hole, and he had to go up to the next door, which was open, and reach through there and shoot Lincoln from that door.
Right.
And that's what he did. Well, what happened was the theater and the government all said that this hole in door 7 was a bullet hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that was published in the press and went everywhere. But one man saw the smoke and the flame, and he said it could not be possible. Mm-hmm. So they sent a commission back with Judge Olin on Sunday, and he examined it very thoroughly and found that the hole had not been fired through. There was also no blood in the box. Major Rathbone was supposed to have been grievously injured. He couldn't find any blood except a little bit on Lincoln's chair. Mm-hmm. And he found the lock had been the screw taken out of in the mortise, and later on they had the board and proved that that's what it was. An interesting thing, they put out the story that Booth had blocked the door with music stands.
Right.
Then that would go along, because a music stand is a ubiquitous item, and he picked up a music stand, and they had gone to the trouble of putting three music stands in the little passageway, so this story would hold water. And what happened, after they took the partition out and hung the flags and whatnot, this Joseph Burrs, the little boy that held the horse,
right,
he was up there. When he was leaving, saw the music stands and realized they shouldn't be there, and he took it on himself to take them out and take them down to where they belonged. So after this was all over, the story was put out, was blocked by a music stand, and O'Reilly's book still has that in there.
Yep.
That Booth blocked it with the music stand. But there weren't any in there, so they had to back that story up. And then they finally got caught on the board that Spangler made. But that's still in there in O'Reilly's book.
Mm-hmm. Well, he hasn't talked to you yet.
No.
He needs to change it.
He may never. I don't think he ever will. But the placement of the chairs expedited Booth getting out.
And the escape, you know, he landed, I think there was like, he was facing a crowd of 1,000 people, hostile people.
They did.
Yeah.
You know, this was the most dangerous part. This had been planned out. And when he hit the stage, three people from the audience jumped up on the stage to help him. One was an orchestra leader named William Withers. And the other was Major Joseph Stewart, who was a lawyer in the Union Army. He was the biggest man in Washington. He was 6'5" tall and described as rather stout. He jumps up on the stage, and another man named E.D. Ray, spelled W-R-A-Y. And this is all their testimony, is all in the archives, signed of what they did. Mm-hmm. Withers got on the stage before the shot was fired.
Right.
Now, this, if you can imagine, an orchestra director getting up on a stage while the show was being going on before the shot's fired, because he said that. He was up there on the stage when the shot was fired, because he had to block the left-hand side door. Ford Theater didn't sell any of the other box seats, mm-hmm, because the two boxes at the stage level, anybody could have jumped out and got on there. So they didn't sell any more box seats, so nobody could get on the stage to follow Booth. And this infuriated Colonel Burnett, who was running this, so much he had all the ticket sellers arrested.
Mm.
And then when Joseph Stewart, his job was to block the door.
Right.
And he was going to run out after Booth and keep anybody from following Booth. And he almost succeeded, but there was a man, a carpenter there by the name of Jacob Ritterspall, mm-hmm, who was working on the stage, and he chased Booth and got ahead of Major Stewart. And he chased Booth, and he caught him right at the door going into the alley.
Right.
And Booth turned and had a knife and slashed at him with the knife,
mm-hmm,
and had the door open, and Ritterspaw jumps back. And then Booth goes out into the alley and slams the door. And then Ritterspaw opens the door, and he sees he's too late. Booth is already on the horse, starting down the alley, and he has no chance to catch him. So he comes back in, and he leaves the door open. He said he left the door open. He was questioned again about this and said he left the door open. And Joseph Burrs, who was in the alley, said the door was open. Well, Major Stewart arrives next, and he shuts the door and then fumbles at the door for 20 or 30 seconds, long enough for Booth to get away, and then opens the door and comes out with the crowd behind him. And Booth's already gone, because everybody's saying, which way did he go? Which way did he go? And that testimony was given, that's also in the archives.
I'm going to make a couple of really important points, and then I'll let you talk about it. I've always questioned Lincoln's lack of security that night. It was ridiculous. And it seems that Booth should not have been allowed anywhere near that presidential box anyway. The Smithsonian Magazine did a story on this a few years back. John Parker, right, was the bodyguard, initially left his position to watch the play, and then he went to the saloon next door for intermission. It was the same saloon where Booth was drinking. No one knows where Parker was during the assassination, but he was not at the position at the door to the booth. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Also, John Parker is the one that escorted Lincoln and his entourage to their booth.
Right.
When he went through the door, he opened the door. The door opened in.
Right.
He had to see the 2-inch by 5-inch plank that was 3.5 feet long and the mortise behind the door. Then when he opens the door, that's hidden. The people that came after him didn't see it, but Parker had to see that. And then after seating Lincoln and his party into the box, on the way out, Parker leaves door number 8 open.
Right.
He didn't close it. So there, when Booth came in, Major Rathbone was sitting. He was facing 180 degrees away from the stage. He was facing the back of the theater.
Right.
He had the worst seat in the house. He was looking exactly the wrong way, but one thing he was looking at was directly at the door, which was open, which led into the little out passageway, and he was only 7.5 feet from it, looking directly into it, and he had to see Booth come into the passageway, draw the pistol, and aim at the president, and he did absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
He had to be involved in the conspiracy.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the lack of security that night was, you know, horrendous, you know.
Well, people nowadays don't realize that back then, security was kind of an on and off again thing. Sometimes you had it, and sometimes you didn't. Lincoln used to let people come into the White House at night that had petitions, you know, and he would get up in the morning and there'd be half a dozen or a dozen people waiting to see him with some kind of thing, some kind of favor they wanted or a parole or something like that, and nobody ever weeded them out. Lincoln just didn't care about security that much.
Now, a lot of people ask, too, wasn't there any Secret Service back then, but it didn't exist? And what I understand, I understand Lincoln signed a bill creating it that night before he left for Ford's Theater. That's what I read. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know if that's true or not. It was created by Lafayette Baker.
Right.
And Baker was a detective put in charge of catching Booth. And he's the one that instituted it. He was also in on the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And he deliberately delayed a lot of this stuff so that Booth could get away. He delayed his search until Booth had made his escape good.
Now, a huge piece of evidence that would clear a lot of things up is to exhume Booth's body, and nobody has been able to do that.
That's been blocked by the government ever since it's been tried.
Exactly.
And if they do, they're going to find one thing, that Booth's left leg is going to be gone, or the body's left leg, and then you have to match it with DNA and what's known as teleoradiography, where they take an X-ray of the skull against a picture of Booth and superimpose it in such a way and see if it matches. There's critical points it'll match. That's forensic science. When I met the man while I was in the Navy who originally developed this. He was about 85 years old then.
You know, they tried to do this many times. I think wasn't the family even wanted to exhume the body as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. And it finally it went to the Supreme Court, and I think the ruling was there was nothing to be gained by doing it.
Right.
You know, if you're trying to settle an estate or something like that, but they said that there's no plausible reason for doing this. And so they didn't allow it.
One of the rulings was by Judge Kaplan in 1995. He ruled that the exhuming the body should not occur. He concluded that there was no compelling reason. And
yeah, that's it.
They were based on facts that he said that Green Mountain Cemetery was not certain where John Wilkes Booth was buried. And there's no way to get an accurate identification of the body due to the length of the time that has elapsed since Booth was buried. I mean, is that true?
Well, that's what they say, but that's not true.
It's
they
not
know where Booth's buried. You can't identify the body.
Right.
And it's just absolutely not true.
It's amazing. You know, I mean, this would put so many questions to rest, and they still, I mean, you know, it just proves there's something going on here. You know?
Well, the archives did not index material that was detrimental to the story tells me that this they've known about this for a long time and have actively taken steps, all of the Army throughout these many years and the archives, to suppress any information that would lead one to think it was a conspiracy.
Right. And they convicted four of them, and including Mary Surratt. Now, do you think Mary Surratt was guilty?
Don't know. She had nothing to do with it.
She had nothing to do with it?
No.
Hmm.
Mary Surratt was a very devout Catholic lady.
Right.
She had converted to Catholicism. And she really lived her religion. She went to Mass every time you had to go to Mass. She did everything, and she was known as a very religious lady. And she had nothing to do with this. Her son, John, was in the Confederate Secret Service. And his job was to work on... They had a blockade running route from Washington to Virginia. And he managed that. He bought horses, boats, lined up blockade runners, tavern for people to stay at, and that's what he ran. And he also brought in a man named Lewis Whiteman, who he had known in school, to live in Mary Surratt's boarding house.
Right.
And Lewis Whiteman was a Confederate spy. And he was a linguist. He could speak French, German, two or three other languages, and he said he was studying to be a priest. He must have, and Mary Surratt really liked him, and he would do things for her. Whenever she wanted to go to Mass, he would take her to Mass, stay there and bring her back. When she run errands, he would take her, and she thought the world of him, and whenever he was out somewhere at night, she'd wait up for him to make sure he got in. He also was a spy, and he was in the War Department, and he would take material from the War Department. And he had a code book, and he would encode it and then take it down the hall. He was in the same house, and he'd give it to John Surratt, and John Surratt would send it to Richmond. And they claim that Whiteman probably prolonged the war about 6 months because he was able to tell them where troop movements were going. And you've heard of Mosby's Raiders?
Yes.
In that area? Had tremendous success. Well, he would tip Mosby off when they were going to set a trap for him, or he would tip him off when they were going to have a payroll shipment. And Mosby lived a charmed life. He would capture payrolls and then disappear, and he would capture generals and then disappear. They'd have to trade, and no one ever caught him. And when they set traps for him, they never caught him because Whiteman would tip him off. Well, when Lincoln was assassinated, the government was curious about John Surratt. They knew that he'd associated, so they went there and they searched Mary Surratt's house.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Whiteman's room, they found the encryption log, you know, the one he used to code his messages with, and they matched it with one in Lincoln, so they had him as a spy. And he went to Stanton and made a deal, and he testified against Mary Surratt. He absolutely lied
mm-hmm.
and told that she was involved, and he also testified against Dr. Mudd.
Right.
There's more testimony from Lewis Reichman in the archives than I think anybody else. They kept bringing him back every time they needed some, and they finally let him go. And he was looked on as such a traitor and everything else that he couldn't get a job, and he had to write Edwin Stanton a letter and told him he couldn't get a job because of what he'd done, and Stanton gave him a job in the post office.
What was Booth actually killed at Garrett's farm, or was he was not killed there.
No. There's a man named James Boyd.
Right.
And the man that lived James Boyd to there, he was a colored man,
mm-hmm.
and he was worked for a tavern owner named Austin Adams, I'm sorry, in Newport.
Right.
Maryland, which is about 6 or 7 miles from where they cross the Potomac River.
Mm-hmm.
And Surratt had worked out a deal with Austin Adams. So whenever somebody was a blockade runner, they could go to his tavern and stay until they got across the river, and he wouldn't tell anybody. And Surratt kept the bills paid. And when that happened, he had his colored man take this man, James Boyd, to the river for a crossing, which he did, because at that time, what they were looking for, what they needed, was a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed somebody about the size of Booth, and they needed somebody with a scar on his neck, because Booth had one they were going to use for identification purposes.
Right, right.
And he needed somebody who was on crutches. And unfortunately for Boyd, he was all three, except Boyd just only had one crutch. And Booth had two. And Boyd, the colored man, took Boyd to the Potomac River, and he crossed a day ahead of Booth, the day before. There's a thing, is this wasn't in the archive. This was in the Surratt Museum Library.
Right.
His testimony is in there, and he took him there. He crossed the day before Booth did. As I've always said, this is like the shell game with the man at the fair, where
right.
he puts a pea under one walnut hull and has three of them there, and you try to figure out which one's which.
Yeah.
He crossed about the same time. Well, Booth had two crutches. Dr. Mudd said that. Dr. Stewart said that. And Richard Jett said that. All of them said that. Plus, I myself had the same fracture that Booth had,
mm-hmm.
and I know that you have to have two crutches to walk. There's
right.
no doubt about it.
Yep.
James Boyd only had one. They identified Booth with two crutches all the way until he gets across the Rappahannock River, and then when he gets the man in the barn that was killed, only had one. And he threw that down and was walking without the aid of any crutches at all. He was unarmed, going to give himself up when he was shot and killed. So the man that was killed in the barn could not possibly have been the same man that Dr. Mudd described and put the splint on.
So what do you think happened to Booth?
Well, I think when he crossed the Rappahannock,
uh-huh.
he went down the Rappahannock towards the Chesapeake Bay to some farm down there somewhere,
right.
and just disappeared. And I think he escaped by water.
Mm-hmm.
All those farms along there had traveled, used boats a lot. They
yeah.
used boats when they wanted to go to Washington. It was easier to take a boat than it is a horse. And they moved their crops, their tobacco and whatnot. A lot of farms had on their own docks, and they would have these small ships would pull up, load up, and then they would go out, and then they would go around to places like New York or Boston or all delivering the tobacco. And I'm sure Booth got on one of those and escaped into the Atlantic, and he either met another ship or that one took him down around to the Florida coast to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And he went by water.
I was lucky enough to grow up in the area. I know a lot about Mary Surratt. You know, they named a city after Surrattsville, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why would they name a city after her if she was, you know...
Well, it was actually named after her husband. He had a post office there.
Oh, okay. It was named after her husband. Okay. But yeah, still, they still use her name, you know, the name Surrattsville.
Yeah,
Surrattsville,
that's right.
So. Yeah.
And he had a post office and a tavern and whatnot, and it was just that area was named after him. And then he died. Mary Surratt moved to Washington to open a boarding house. That was
right.
Her way of making a living.
Yeah. And my brother-in-law is actually a relative of Dr. Mudd. He's a Mudd. And the Mudd house, I used to live in southern Maryland in Waldorf, and the Mudd house was like 8 minutes from where I used to live. And, you know, the family was very, very happy after they, you know...
Well, there's an awful lot of good testimony about Dr. Mudd with eyewitnesses in the archives, and it all adds up to he is innocent.
Exactly.
All this material was kept from the public. Nobody was ever allowed to see it. And then he was convicted primarily on the testimony of Lewis Weitzman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing what they did to Dr. Mudd. You know,
because the government had to look like that they were making an all-out effort to get everybody.
Yeah.
And so they suck in an innocent like Mudd, who did, and Mary Surratt, and they had two others, Samuel Arnold and Charles O'Loughlin, who had originally been in on the trying to capture him, but was not in on the assassination, but they got them too.
So the Union Army, do you think the Union Army was all kind of part of this, the assassination?
They were the big part of it, yes.
They were the main part.
The Union Army and the Confederate Secret Service were the two main ones. I suspect there may have been a foreign power involved.
Really?
Under the cover, yes. Because if the United States was a fresh country and all a lot of land, and there's a lot of foreign powers who, if there could have been a coup, they could have established a government and had, you know, like a territory or something that would be to their benefit. And I feel like that's very likely, but I don't have the proof.
So why would the Union Army want Lincoln out of the way?
They want Lincoln out of the way because they could make money with him gone.
With him gone.
They could become wealthy.
Right.
And with him there, they didn't.
They didn't, right?
That's right. These officers walked off with hundreds of thousands of dollars, the major officers.
Uh-huh.
And the lower level walked off with $10,000 or $20,000, which at that $20,000 at that time,
a lot of money.
Like $500,000 tax-free. You know, you could live the rest of your life on what you were going to get.
Yeah.
And they felt like they'd fought the war, and they were justified in getting the rewards, and that Lincoln was not going to go along with it.
Mm. Well, Dr. Arnold, your book is fascinating, and you know, I'm going to try to contact Bill O'Reilly, and I would love to get you and him together. I mean, he would, you know, definitely welcome you on the show, I would think.
I don't think he would.
He's afraid.
Yeah. See, I've documented in the book all these photocopies is the actual information from the archives, which are signed statements.
Yeah.
This is primary evidence. It's not secondary. It's what the actual eyewitnesses said.
Well, when you have a guy like O'Reilly, and then you have a guy like you with all your background, you know, being an assistant coroner, a surgeon in the Navy, I mean, I think you win hands down. You know, as far as credibility.
I hope so. Well, his book has a lot of errors in it. I mean, just absolutely factual errors.
Yeah. Well, your book is so important, and everybody needs to read The Conspiracy Between John Wilkes Booth and the Union Army to Assassinate Abraham Lincoln. It's out. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it on Barnes & Noble. It's fascinating. I've never seen a book documented so well like yours, and with all the pictures, the documentation, everything is there. I mean, you can't debunk it. It's all there.
Why I put it in there. There was one publisher who wanted to publish it if I leave it out.
Yeah.
And he said, what good does it do? But I think it does a lot of good where you can see the actual
documents.
You don't have to take my word for it. You can see what whoever said it.
Yeah, it's and there. I know you had some issues trying to get those documents clear in the book, which was very difficult. And you finally did. You took your time. You found the right publisher, and they got it right. I mean, everything looks perfect in the book now.
I wasn't sure it would come out, but it did.
It did. Yeah.
They weren't sure it wasn't even either because it was so old.
Right.
And it's when you're trying to put something like that in print that's that old, you don't know what's gonna fade or run or what.
Right.
It came out pretty good.
Oh, it came out fantastic. I'm really shocked how well it came out. They did a heck of a job. They really did.
They did. But
what's next for you? Are you going to write another book?
No.
No.
I wore myself out on this one. No, I won't. In the book, you know, when they start the chase, the one thing that was the most critical to me was Stanton got a telegram.
Right.
From Major O'Byrne. And the minute he got that telegram, he started the chase. He called for a unit of cavalry, and they went after Booth.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, every book says that the telegram said that Booth and Harold had crossed the Potomac.
Right.
And then they kept the telegram. They never put it, they never indexed it. They put it in a manila folder in the middle of the archive where you couldn't find it unless you just happened to see it. And it does not say that at all. It doesn't say that. It shows beyond a doubt that when Stanton got this telegram, he knew he knew already what the story was. This was a prearranged clue.
Right.
And he said that's when he called the cavalry, and they knew exactly where to go.
So I guess this secret is going to be kept a secret, and that's because the Union Army was involved, and they don't want, I guess, the public to really find out about that. Is it?
Well, the public has no way.
Yeah.
There was a lady tried to, the Columbia Historical Society, in about 1909, when they had a thing for Lincoln's birthday, 100 years old.
Right.
And she wrote a letter to the Army, asked them if they had any information on this, and she got a letter back and said they didn't know, they had no information whatsoever on the pursuit and capture of Booth, and that was it.
Hmm. Now, why, if the family wants Booth's body to be exhumed, why? I thought the family would have the right, you know, to get it done. I guess not, huh?
I thought so too, but I'm not a lawyer, and
right.
I know they wanted it done, and they didn't get it done. Now, when you go through a lawyer, you know, you rub two lawyers together, you know what you get, and they didn't get it.
Very, very strange. You know, I thought they would have complete control over that. So,
I did too. I thought if you wanted an autopsy or your loved one to be checked for death and penal cause or something like that.
Yeah.
But they would, but they didn't.
Dr. Arnold, anything else you'd like to add?
No, it's been a pleasure, Ray.
Me too. We're going to do a lot more of these interviews. I thank you so much for being on the show today. May you have great success with your new book. It's incredible. It should be a bestseller. It really should. And
the way I wrote it, I don't care. I want somebody 50 years from now
right.
to read this book and realize, well, I may be long dead, But to read this book and have the true story out of what actually did happen.
You know, the way you tell it, it sounds like you were there. You know, it really does.
You know, Ray, I'll tell you something, Ray. While I was writing the book, there were times I felt like I was there. That sounds strange, but I would get so involved in what was going on that I felt like I was part of it.
And when you dream at night, I mean, yeah, I'm an author as well, and it does happen. You know, you start dreaming about the story, and you know, the story becomes you. It's amazing.
Yes, it
people,
does.
A lot of people don't understand how hard it is to be an author because your whole life is involved with the book, and it takes a lot of time.
Dream about it, and you feel like you're part of it, that you're standing there. You're standing there in front of Ford Theater by the gaslight with Booth and Gifford, right? And when Booth goes in, and you can't do anything. Nobody listens to you. You know, you just have to stand there and watch.
I know.
Watch him go in the theater and kill Lincoln.
Yeah, yeah. What a story, you know, in American history. It's I'm glad you wrote the book and the truth is out. Thank you so much again for being on the show. I appreciate it. And, you know, again, good luck with the book. And I'll do my best to try to get a debate with you and Bill O'Reilly on national TV. I think that'd be interesting.
I'll be there. I don't know what he will. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Dr. Arnold. I appreciate it. All right. Take care. Bye-bye now. Purchase The Conspiracy Between John Wilkes Booth and the Union Army to Assassinate Abraham Lincoln by Robert E. Arnold today at barnesandnoble.com, also at amazon.com. For further information about author Robert E. Arnold, visit his websites at abrahamlincolnassassination.wordpress.com. He also has a Wix site, which is a kind of a strange address, but it's a great site. http://ray2178.wix.com/Lincoln Conspiracy. He's also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/Lincoln Assassination Conspiracy. He's also on Twitter account, https://twitter.com/newbooklincoln. And you can also find Captain Robert E. Arnold at Goodreads. It's just punch in Captain Robert E. Arnold, MD, USNRR. For publicity and booking information, you can contact me, Ray Shasho, at the Publicity Works Agency at 941-877-1552 or email ray@publicityworksagency.com. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Please join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., also available now at Amazon.com, and I promise you'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by The Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.